We're going to break all the rules. We're going to call the meeting to order. We're going to have a presentation by Mr. Seamount, who we will have another presentation, an official one, which we have noticed. If you have any questions between now and the next week, or however long the notice needs to be, prepare them and we'll ask you then. But in the meantime, Dan Seamount, you've got a copy of his bio or his resume, I believe, in front of you. And if you can kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and why you would want to do this job again.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan Seamount. I have been a commissioner in a geologic seat for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission since February the year 2000. I've been doing this for 5 years. When I came before the legislature 5 years ago, at my first confirmation hearing, I said that I wanted the job because the state has been very good to me, and I wanted to give something back to the people of the state of Alaska. Also, of course, the job is extremely interesting and satisfying. There are different issues coming at me every day. I've become addicted to the excitement of the job, and I'd like to continue working in the interests of the people of the state. There's been a lot accomplished in the last 5 years at the commission. I can't claim 100% credit for it, or even 50%. It's a team effort. We've got a very good group of people working at the commission. They help each other out, and I think most of the time we come to the right decisions. I can talk to those accomplishments, but I'll do it if you have questions on any of them. We can talk about them, but in the interest of time, I'll leave that up to your discretion, Mr. Chairman. And also, we have a lot of very important issues to address coming over in the coming years. Probably the biggest is the mitigation of oil losses due to major gas sales from the North Slope. We need to address that. See how we can how the operators can take as much oil out as they can while they're extracting the gas. There's expanded statewide exploration and development in the NPRA, which we're hoping will increase production. That's going to mean a lot more work for the AOGCC in oversight of this. Also, we've been on a performance enhancement project at AOGCC. In the last 3 years, we have streamlined the permitting process. For example, we've gone from 21 to 28 well days per well permit to get a permit through the office. Now we're down to 5 to 10 days, and we've been holding pretty steady on that since. So hopefully faster permit decisions will lead to fuller development of our resources. We're also in an endeavor to decrease or maintain our budget, or even decrease it, looking for ways to cut costs while at the same time deliver the services that the state needs. That's just a few of the things that we're working on. Our budget narrative will have a much more complete list when that comes out, I think, in the near future. So with that, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Seamount at this time? No? Representative Gatto.
Small question. I notice in your resume you do, especially in your thesis and on some of the earlier stuff for Union Oil, that you deal a lot with well logs.
Through the chair, yes, that's right, Representative Gatto.
Are the well logs confidential information for the most part? I mean, if I'm an oil company and I drilled a $50,000 hole, I certainly don't want to give that information away.
Through the chair, yes, well logs on a normal well are confidential for 2 years. After 2 years, if the oil company wants to keep confidentiality, they'll go to the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, who will make a decision. For example, the Anwar whale, Ikik number one, is probably the most valuable whale information in the world. And we have that stored in a vault at an undisclosed location, and it has been confidential since 1986.
So it'd be inappropriate for you to tell us what's in it.
Through the chair, I am one of the two people in the world that has a key to that vault, and I refuse to even open it because I don't want my DNA in there in case it ever gets out. No, I don't know what's in that well.
Are there any more questions, Mr. Seamount? Mr. Ramos.
Mr. Seamount, can you just tell me if you use your crystal ball, what's the future of the Cook Inlet? How do you see that being exploited?
Through the chair, Representative Ramos, as a geologist that's worked Cook Inlet for over 12 years, there is a tremendous amount of potential left there, and I was prepared to speak on that when we talk about HCR7. Only 4% of the oil has ever been found there. Only 4% of the oil has been identified. Oil. And that's about 3 billion barrels of oil is 4%. So you can imagine how much oil is unaccounted for in just that little basin.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And I don't know if you or Ms. Forster wants to address the conversations that we'd had earlier on the gas, if you want to pass the buck on that one.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to pass the buck.
Okay.
Commissioner Forrester is an expert at reservoir modeling and petroleum engineering, and that's what that issue is about.
Okay, and then we'll let you know when the actual hearing for the confirmation gets noticed, and probably have you online. But in the meantime, if there's any questions, if members can get them to me or directly to Mr. Seamount, so he can address them next week. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we've got Kathy Forrester. Want to kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and a little background, and then I've got some questions on gas for you.
Just a few.
We only go to three.
For the record, my name is Kathy Forrester. First, I would like to thank you guys for squeezing us in this afternoon on a very busy part of your agenda. I was raised in a family where we like to give more than we get, and in the 13 years that my family and I have been here, the state of Alaska has done so much for us that I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to give something back. My training and experiences as a petroleum engineer make the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission possibly the ideal place for me to serve the state of Alaska. I've had engineering assignments from reservoir development to facilities design. I've had opportunities to supervise and manage groups from small technical, highly technical groups of engineers and scientists to very large operations groups of mainly skilled and unskilled laborers. The first 15 years of my career, I worked mainly in Texas and offshore Louisiana, but for the last 13 years, I've been working projects in the North Slope of Alaska. Everything from operations manager at Prudhoe Bay to new development supervisor in the Western North Slope.
Recording stopped.
But you need to continue.
And I will. You have my resumes before you, but a few of the things that I've done here in Alaska, I'm particularly proud of, and I think that they will benefit me in serving on the AOGCC, and if you don't mind, I'll highlight those for you. When I first moved here, I got the opportunity to be the production superintendent for the Prudhoe Bay Wells Group, a group that was instrumental while I was there in pioneering the coil tubing drilling that is doing so much to get extra reserves off the slope for Alaska right now. Now, I want to clarify, I was not one of the technically brilliant people doing that wonderful work. I was just the manager enabling them to do that. So I can only take credit for being there. I had the privilege later to lead a strategic business review of the WestSAC. The recommendations of my review team have led to the WESAC development that the state of Alaska is enjoying right now. And more recently, I was on a consulting team that did a report for the Department of Natural Resources with recommendations on how the state of Alaska can assist the new operators trying to get a foothold on the North Slope in gaining facility access. So in summary, throughout my career, I've had plenty of opportunities to learn new things and contribute at the same time, and I see this opportunity as just another one of those. I'm especially excited about the opportunity to work with such a well-respected commission and in concert with intelligent, hardworking, honest, and ethical gentlemen like Dan Seamount and John Norman. You can pay me later. Thank you.
Representative Ramos.
Would you just discuss for a couple minutes for me what the horizon is like for all the heavy viscous oil that we hear about up on the North Slope, you know, and how long you see that time horizon, you know, is it a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year time horizon, and what will be the story of viscous oil as technology catches up to the product?
Through the chair, Representative Ramos. And if I forget to answer any part of that question, please remind me. The future that I see for viscous oil in Alaska is optimistically a long one. The biggest hurdle to it being a long one is the life of the facilities up there. You know, the facilities that we're producing from up there are currently producing beyond their original design length. There are trillions of cubic feet of resource in trillions of cubic feet, forgive me, trillions of barrels of heavy resource up there that we can get to with enough time. However, the facility's life is working against us. I see the majors doing what they do in every basin they come into, getting the things that hit their economic limits. But I see the independents already coming in and extending the life of what we've got on the North Slope in the way that they do in every other basin. As the majors start to pull away, the independents come in and scrape the pot. They do that because they have lower operating costs. They have less baggage to carry with them and support all of their projects with. So I see a real similar opportunity here to what we see in every other basin around the world. And again, I see the biggest hurdle keeping the facilities going strong.
Thank you.
Senator Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If we pull North Slope gas to market, we lose oil production. There has to be a number of TCF that we're willing to take before it has whatever the perfect amount is. Do we have any idea what that is, or are we just going to pull natural gas and use some other technology to push oil out?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, in a perfect world where you don't have time limits on other things, the optimal way to blow down a gas cap is to wait till every barrel of oil is gone. Mm-hmm. And if we had a perfect world with no other variables, that's what our commission would have to recommend, because our job is to prevent waste. And the only way to prevent any waste in a perfect world is to do it that way. However, we have other variables, the life of the facilities, the markets for natural gas and natural gas liquids around the world, and the readiness of people to come into the market. All those other things are going to come to play. Those aren't primarily the concern of the AOGCC, but we'll have to keep those in mind as we consider the optimal way. Now, given that we will likely be producing the gas before all the oil is gone, again, in an ideal world, the less gas you produce and the later you produce it, the better for ultimate oil recovery. However, there are things that we possibly can do to encourage the operators to accelerate the oil production. We can't make them do things that aren't economically justifiable, but we can encourage them to accelerate the oil production, which will enable us to be producing the gas quicker with a lower impact. And at the end of the day, with those other variables that we have to consider, we want to maximize hydrocarbon recovery, not just oil recovery. So there will be a balance. Did I answer your question?
No.
No. Okay.
It would take us, I don't know, thousands of years to get the last barrel out because of diminishing returns. It takes more and more effort to get the last few drops out. But at some point, and I guess I'm asking you, and it won't help me, but I'm curious to know what the point is where we give away, by leaving in the ground, a certain number of barrels of oil in the exchange for getting, I guess, all of the gas out, right?
Most of it.
And let's say we reach the point where we've got the gas, there's oil in the ground. Is there some way to get the oil out using other than the natural gas?
Through the chair. Again, we want to maximize total hydrocarbon recovery. So if we leave some oil in the ground, we hope that we do it to the total good of oil and gas combined. That will be our mission, to try to do that. Now, in answer to the question, when we get all the gas out and there's some oil left in the ground, what will have happened, and the reason that, and if I get too reservoir engineering for you, stop me. But what happens is, as you deplete the gas cap, the oil moves into rocks that used to not be wetted by oil. They used to be just, the rock face only had gas touching it. So now what happens is that oil comes in there, and it adheres to the sides of the rock grains. And it's like when you drain the oil in your car. You put the oil into a little container, and you dump it out, and you shake it, and you do all you're going to do to it. But when you finish, there's still some oil on the sides. And then you might take a little surfactant and scrub it a little bit and get a little more oil off, but there's still some oil that sticks to the side. And that's what happens to those rock grains when oil comes in to the gas cap that never had oil there before. Okay? And the other thing that's happening is that reservoir pressure is being depleted with that gas cap removal, with the removal of the gas from the gas cap. So when that energy, that pressure is gone, then you no longer have the ability to get the oil out. So what you're trying to do is get as much of the oil out before it starts moving into the gas cap.
Any other questions? Yes. Senator Ramers.
Thank you. What's today's mission for the AOGCC?
Well, there are four pieces of our mission. It's to prevent waste of hydrocarbons, to encourage maximum ultimate recovery of hydrocarbons, to protect ground waters, and to protect correlative rights. Those were four. Prevent waste, maximize recovery, protect the ground waters, and protect correlative rights.
Are there any other questions?
Through the chair, protect correlative rights. That means if there are multiple landowners, make sure that each one gets his fair share of the resource.
I got one question for you. We talked about your experience on the North Slope. If you look at, we passed out of here, and I believe it passed out of House Finance also, is exploration credits and some lease sales that will hopefully be coming up on the Alaska Peninsula. From AOGCC's perspective, it's just a geological question. It doesn't really matter to you one way or another where it is. And I mean, you pointed out your experience on the slope. Is that relevant to something on the peninsula or the Nana Basin or in other formations, or you look at the seismic and do your job? Does it matter one way or another?
Since most of what we do is underground, a reservoir is a reservoir, and the same physics that applies on the North Slope or in Texas will apply in other parts of the state of Alaska.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? When we have our notice, we will have you call in or something. But and the same as with Mr. Seamount, if there's any other questions or comments, either get them to me and I can get them to her, or you can contact her directly. But thank you very much.
Thank you all.
I felt sorry for you for being thrown in the mix, and then I looked on here that says that you were a lobbyist before Alaska State Legislature, so you're used to it. So I lost my sympathy.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you taking things a little out of regular order so we could meet these people personally while they were here.
Yep.
That's helpful.
Yep. Okay. First, what's that? Oh, we'll be all right. All we have is a presentation from some private citizens. For the rest of the agenda today, we have HCR 7, and then Co-Chairman Ramis will be handling HB 9. We'll take a brief Eddie's. What do you want to do? HCR 7.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eleanor Wolf. I'm staff to Representative Olson. Before you today, you have HCR 7. You have the sponsor statement in your packet. I'm not going to waste your time by reading it to you. Potentially, with some of the oil and gas platforms, the Cook Inlet in excess of 40 years old, the subject of abandonment regulations has become an important issue. Industry showed an interest in having these regulations reviewed back as early as 1996, and they reissued their requirement request at a committee meeting held in Kenai in February. As there will be a large number of entities involved, it will be very time-consuming, as it's imperative that the process begin as soon as possible, particularly considering the impending sale of Unocal. Potential participants in this process are environmental groups such as Cook Inlet Keeper, Trustees for Alaska, also varied industry members, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Conservation, AOGCC, and others. These regulations have needed to be revised since prior to 96, and this resolution requests that a comprehensive review be undertaken by DNR. I believe we have Mark Myers online if we have any technical questions.
Okay. Are there any questions for Eleanor? No? Thank you. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Online first, we'll start with Mark Myers, the Division of Oil and Gas. Mark, do you want to testify or just answer questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could make a brief statement if you'd like and then answer questions.
Sure, that'd be great.
Questions. Basically, the department is fine with this resolution. I think Eleanor did a nice job of summarizing the issue. We have, again, 16 platforms in the inlet, four of which are in lighthouse status, meaning that they basically are no longer in operation, and the top sides have been basically cleaned and the wells at least temporarily plugged and abandoned. So we're in a situation where these platforms are not economic under the current for production of the current known reserves. We have many other platforms that are producing at much below their peak levels of production, and the issue of what will be the ultimate abandonment standards needs to be addressed in the near future. As was mentioned, there are a lot of different stakeholders involved with the process. Under the lease terms, basically they're required to fully remove and abandon all the facilities, remove all the underground pipelines, or excuse me, seafloor pipelines, and permanently plug and abandon the wells to AOGCC satisfaction. One of the questions is there's still exploration potential, and Commissioner Seamount previously has testified, and he's right on, that there are lower, deeper targets as well as some additional remaining reserves in some of these not fully depleted reservoirs. So the question is, can someone else economically operate the platforms, should they be removed permanently, and if they are removed permanently, to what extent should they be removed? Should the platforms be totally removed? Should part of the platforms left be remaining for other purposes in the inlet? And then to what standards are they, navigation hazards, et cetera. So when we look at the list of stakeholders, it's a huge list, including Coast Guard folks and navigation issues, as well as many of the major state agencies. So we know we need a process. We know we need to come to grips with these standards. It will probably end up not being a one-size-fits-all standard. It wouldn't be appropriate to the individual situations with each platform. But we need to create this process. We need to go through it from a regulatory standpoint. So we're prepared to do that. It's going to take us, again, I think, a little bit of time to develop the task force together and get the folks working on it. But this urges us to do that, and we're in agreement we need to do it. So, again, we're not stressed at all by this resolution, and we support the concept of moving forward with the process. With that, I'll answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think you have a question from Representative Ramirez.
Hi, Mark. Nice to hear your voice. I wanted to find out from you these lighthouse platforms. What would it cost to mitigate one, to tear it down and clean it up? What is the liability that the existing platform owners have insofar as taking them down and removing them to establish some kind of value?
Mr. Co-Chair, through the chair, my guess is between $2 to $10 million per platform, depending on exactly what you're requiring, and then dealing with the underground pipelines. One of the challenges is a lot of the infrastructure to service existing platforms or platforms that are most likely to continue under production runs through the legs of these other platforms. So it's like having to reroute the entire electrical situation in your house because you're closing off one room, sort of thing. So there's lots of interrelated pipeline infrastructure and power infrastructure so that runs between the pipelines. So there are economic effects, but fundamentally it's in the millions of dollars to bring in the specialized equipment that would then cut the legs off, presumably at the mud line, and then physically try to remove or reuse the platforms. Alternatives to that would be go ahead and let the platform collapse the seafloor bottom, use it as a natural reef, or continue to use it for additional oil and gas exploration up to the point that you reach an abandonment stage, or use it for other uses. California, they're looking at things like fish farming, et cetera. One of the things we want to make sure that doesn't happen is that the liability for abandonment falls back on the state. So we need to have the deep pockets. But the long answer to your question, it really depends on the full level of abandonment required. But for full-scale abandonment, it's at least $2 million and probably as high as $10 million per platform.
Mark, are you advocating fish farming?
I guess my answer to that is we deal with a different kind of oil rather than fish oil here.
Mark, a follow-up, please, Mr. Chairman. What does it cost to put a new platform into the Cook Inlet?
Representative Ramirez, the chair, it would be in the same tens of billions of dollars, probably. You'd have to construct it. The last example of that is the Osprey platform, and Forrest would have better numbers. But generally in the tens to maybe $20 million range, I guess, just for the platform itself, and then you'd have the cost of the rig and drilling the rigs. So very expensive assets, and unless your exploration targets are large enough, typically for oil in the 20 million barrel range plus size, and you could do a decent rate out of the reservoir, you couldn't justify the economics of putting a new platform in.
Do you, Mark, you're familiar with the, Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
You're familiar with the competitive nature of some of the major producers down there and the aggressive stance that they take with some of the growing independent oil companies. Is there something that the state's going to do to be able to induce, a sale, a movement from the majors? I mean, like the Agrium plant, you know, you're familiar with the problem we have there where Agrium doesn't want to sell to somebody else because they don't want to create a competitor. Are we likely to see a problem like that with these lighthouse platforms?
Representative Ramirez, the chair, I don't believe the issue is quite the same. In a sense, Cook Inlet does not have enough oil production. It uses all the oil production it can internally at the local refinery. In fact, the local refinery could, in fact, use more oil. So there's not an export or competitive situation down there in the upstream oil and gas part of the business. I think the bigger issue is, as you see the rates of the platform go down, there's still many of the platforms that are profitable, but a large corporation wants a lot more profit than these platforms would generate. It's a classic case where independents want to take over, and they can operate them at a much lower overhead cost and make a lot of money on them. The other thing is the larger companies, I think, look at their deep pockets and say, I have liability for the platforms in case there's an oil spill, or I have this final abandonment liability, and just assume get out from underneath it and take the cash that's either I have set aside for this or may have to set aside for this for abandonment and use it someplace else. So they want to go ahead and sell the asset. And I don't think there would be any problem with them selling it in most cases. There's some platforms that are very, very lucrative down there still. But in the case of the marginal platforms, I don't think you'll see the majors opposing a sale. I think they were worried about the terms and conditions of the sale. So the state's worried about it to some extent, in that we want to make sure the new operator is qualified to operate the platform safely and that we still maintain the deep pockets for abandonment back to the original operator so that in the case the company does go bankrupt or hits financial times, that there is weather ability, not on the state's nickel, but on the lessee's nickel, to actually abandon it. So I think the issue is the uncertainty about these abandonment costs plays into this, the liability costs play into it, and I think the big companies just look at the assets and say, well, they're smaller assets and they don't really fit in our portfolio. So I think generally they would encourage on the marginal platforms for them to be transferred. I don't think there would be any sort of block by the majors. On the more lucrative platforms, it's a different story. There are a few platforms on there that are very, very lucrative, and those the majors, I'm sure, want to keep themselves.
Thank you, Mark.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I know that those Cook Inlet platforms have to deal with a lot of ice, and they have to do pretty regular maintenance on them to keep them safe. How long do you think that those platforms can stand in lighthouse status if they're not doing maintenance to protect them from, or you know, upgrade them from damage from the ice and from regular rust and degeneration?
Representative Carl, to the chair, that's a very good question. There are protections, the cathodic protection from we have that are on the platforms will provide some protection. Certainly, they appear, I guess, on first blush to be adequate for 10 to 20 years or so. And again, I think you have to review that in each platform's case. But certainly, there's a time clock. I don't think we're at the stage where anyone believes they're unstable. The platforms that are right now are physically strong. Again, the question is, in this lighthouse situation, when you go to the next stage, if you were not to require their removal, what other conditions for maintenance and inspection would you require? I think that's all part of this developing a system of regulations that looks at the platforms from an individual basis, but provides some general standards and guidance to the companies. But it's a very good question. At some point, if they're not properly maintained or if money isn't put back into them, they will become unstable, and we have to be able to deal with that issue if we don't require their full removal.
Mark, might I suggest, other than fish farms, maybe you would think about wind generators or low head tidal generators.
President Crawford, for the chair, I think that's, again, looking at all the existing uses. I wasn't trying to say fish farm for Alaska. I just know that's been for offshore California. I've learned my lesson.
Okay. Any other questions for Mark? Got a couple other people to testify here still. So, Representative Gatto?
Easy one, Mark. If the oil companies wanted to get rid of the platforms, could they get permission to blow them up and have them settle down to the bottom and literally become fish habitat, or is there EPA regulations that would actually prohibit that?
Representative Gatto, to the chair, I think that would probably be a permissible use, assuming, again, it met the standards of the regulation process or the public process we would go through. With the tidal currents and the scour that goes on below sea floor, we'd have to make sure that, again, that this would be relatively stable and would provide good habitat. Certainly that's one of the possible end uses. There certainly would be the process in addition to our process, the ACMP coastal zone management process would go through, and you'd have to look at it real carefully. But I guess fundamentally, the state has tremendous discretion in its lease terms, and if it was more appropriate and better for the environment to collapse it once you'd totally cleaned and scrubbed it, that would be probably within the purview of the DNR commissioner to apply as the application. We'd have to, again, look at it case-by-case basis, and there may be some areas of the inlet as well, just guessing at the the bathymetry and the oceanography, what would be better than others to do that.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mark? Okay, thanks for being with us, Mark. Next up, we've got from Kenai, Mike Munger with the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council. Are you with us, Mike?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Hello, my name for the record is Michael Munger. I'm the Executive Director of the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC, which is a nonprofit corporation that's organized exclusively for the oversight, monitoring, assessing, and evaluation of oil spill prevention, safety, and response plans, terminal and oil tanker operations, and environmental impacts of oil tanker and oil terminal operations in Cook Inlet. I'm here today to inform the committee that CIRCAC has very similar interests in Cook Inlet platform removal. One of our many projects was to take a detailed look at the aspects of what we call DR&R, which is dismantlement, removal, and restoration of the Cook Inlet offshore production platforms. Basically, the basis for this HCR-7 is essentially what we discovered, too. One of the more interesting revelations that's come out of our research on the subject is that DNR has no specific statutes or regulations governing the leasee's DNR&R obligations. Rather, DNR&R will determine a leasee's ultimate DNR&R obligations on a case-by-case basis based on the individual circumstances of each site. HCR-7 ultimately will address this concern by directing the agency, DNR, to develop these regulations. This will have numerous benefits, as we've heard through the testimony today, for the regulators, the regulated community, and the stakeholders in Cook Inlet. We've developed a white paper, which has had input from various state and federal agencies, including DNR, the oil producers and stakeholders of Cook Inlet, and it'll be ready for release in May. This paper is a compilation of our research into the issue. We will, of course, be willing to share this with the committee and with any interested party, as we do with all our programs and projects. Thank you for the opportunity today to address the committee on this, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Munger? Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. Last and certainly not least, batting cleanup is Dan Seamount from AOGCC. I've got Kathy Forster on the list here to testify also. Are you just going to cover representing the organization?
Just I'm going to testify on this.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan Seamount. I'm one of the three commissioners at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We oversee issues relating to conservation of resource. So we're looking at this this resolution slightly differently, although we support it. Mark Myers did a very good job of describing what the issues are with what do you do with the platforms after they're gone. I'm taking a small part of that and saying that we need to look at what we're going to need to think about abandoning these platforms, be really careful about it, because there's a lot of oil left on under Cook Inlet that is accessible from these platforms. As far as the Doan reservoirs are concerned, some of the platforms that have been lighthouse have recovered only less than 30% of the original oil in place. This compares with Prudhoe Bay, with recoveries of greater than 50% of the original oil in place. There are hundreds of millions of barrels left in the produced fields of Cook Inlet. We feel that motivated and energized production companies such as XTO should be encouraged to use new technology to recover as much of the known oil as possible that is reachable from these platforms. Now, there's also exploration potential in Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet has had 300 exploration wells drilled in it. It's got approximately 1,000 total wells in the basin, the 10,000 square mile basin, which is about the same size as the San Juan Basin in New Mexico. That basin has 29,000 wells, and discoveries are still being made. Cook Inlet is regarded as a mature oil-producing province, and it is. It's been producing for 40 years. But it is, in my opinion, or in our opinion, very much underexplored. Leslie Magoon, who is a USGS expert in geology and geochemistry, has done a study on the source of the oil in the basin, in Cook Inlet Basin, And he's concluded it's only 4% of the oil that's been generated has ever been identified. And if you say, okay, well, there's maybe 3 billion barrels of oil and original oil in place that's been identified in the basin, that comes out to 75 billion barrels of oil that was generated, and no one knows where it went. It may have escaped to the surface, or there may be a lot of it left in undiscovered reservoirs and undiscovered rocks. And having worked it for 12 years, worked the basin as an exploration geologist, I think a lot of oil still left trapped under the ground somewhere. And a lot of it, I think, would be accessible from these platforms. There's numerous known untested fault blocks. And there's other exploratory prospects that have been identified by petroleum geologists over the last 50 years. These have not been drilled. They've been identified, and they can be reached from the platforms. Probably the highest potential play is in the pre-tertiary Cretaceous and Jurassic rocks, where almost all the oil was generated. Dr. Magoon has identified the source rocks within the Jurassic. To date, only 55 wells have been drilled into this pre-tertiary section, and most of them have only gone into the, have only scratched the surface, gone a few hundred feet into it. Little is known of the productive potential. We feel that it makes sense to re-enter idle well bores and drill maybe another 5,000 feet into this section to just see what's down there. The rocks are folded and faulted up so badly that it makes seismic identification of the prospects at these depths very difficult. So probably the best way to test this potential is just to re-enter old well bores and drill away and see what you got down there. So there are four tiers of potential left in Cook Inlet. One is discovered reservoirs that have been underproduced, less than 30% recovery. There are untested fault blocks that separate the known reservoir from its equivalent under and off to the sides of the platforms. There are identified prospects that have been around for years and not been tested. And then there's the deep Jurassic and Cretaceous potential. We feel that these platforms should be viewed as assets, and we recommend that all parties, and Mr. Myers has stated this, we recommend that all parties, all stakeholders, be very careful when considering abandonment. And the AOGCC feels that we should do everything we can to test the potential of the oil and gas wells before these platforms are taken away. Right now, we have a window of opportunity to capture the additional reserves. Of course, abandonment would close that window. Once the window closes, much of the state's resources and the Kenai Peninsula's economic potential could be lost. And with that, I thank you, and I'll answer questions.
When you talked about one of the types is the underproduced areas, is it relatively, and easy is a bad term, but I'm going to use it anyway. Is it easy for AOGCC to tell the difference between what is a true exploratory well and what would be a well going to an underproduced area that would be considered a production well?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think we have the expertise to accurately separate them out.
And that's just in Cook Inlet, or would that just be across the spectrum?
We can do that anywhere in the state.
Okay, thanks. Representative Crawford had a question.
You talked a lot about the oil that's still there. What do you think about the gas potential? Is there a gas potential from these old wells as well?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, yes, I believe that there is gas potential, especially at depth. The deeper you go, I think the greater your potential for gas and lighter hydrocarbons being produced is greater than it is up higher. In fact, the gas oil ratio is fairly low in the presently produced reservoir. So where is that gas? It may have been trapped in deeper reservoirs as the heavier oil was leaking to the surface.
Any other questions for Dan? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on HCR 7? Anybody else online who wishes to testify? With that, we'll close public testimony, and I see that we have one amendment here from the sponsor.
Yeah, I'd like to offer up an amendment. Basically, it would delete smaller on page 2, line 6, and insert growing and independent, which better describes the nature of the companies that are, you know, the next generation of companies that are coming into Cook Inlet.
Okay. Amendment number 1 has been moved. Is there any objection? Hearing none, amendment 1 is carried. Are there any other amendments? Read a motion.
We entertain a motion to move House Resolution 7 as amended with attached fiscal note out of committee.
Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, HCR as amended passes from committee. I think we're very, very short at ease.
Oh, ready, Harry?
So what is it?
We're back on record. HCR.
HB9,
sorry. Deja vu. Representative Crawford, tell us about hydrogen energy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chairman. I'm back again. It's kind of like deja vu all over again. For those of us that were here in past sessions, we've already passed this out of the House. What this does is it creates a hydrogen energy partnership, and gives us the ability to have a repository for grant money to do hydrogen research and development projects. We believe that hydrogen is, what I like to say is I think that hydrogen could be our next Prudhoe Bay, not because it's an energy source itself, but because it's a medium for storage and movement of alternative sorts of energy, where you have tidal power, wind power, geothermal power in areas where you don't have a need for that power. Or you don't have the need for it at the time that the wind's blowing or the water's running. You can store that power with hydrogen, or you can use hydrogen to move that to other markets. And we believe that it's the fuel of the future, and I would be glad to answer any questions that you might have, and then I'd get out of the way in favor of any experts that might want to speak on it.
Questions for Representative Crawford? Representative Gatto?
Got to hold on one second. I don't understand something here, and I'm.
I'll pose one to you, Representative Crawford. Shows a fiscal note for 06 indicates that federal funds would be found in ensuing years. It says that in the event funds are not obtained, provisions would be repealed as outlined in this bill. What provisions would be repealed that are outlined in this bill if we're unable to fund this in ensuing years with federal money?
Basically what that says is that this is not going to be funded by general funds. That if we don't have ongoing grant money, that this will go away.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. Representative Gatto, you ready?
I got it. It wasn't clear, but it's clear.
No questions?
No question.
Any other questions for sponsor? Back to your seat, sir. We have some folks online. Mr. Morgan from Golden Valley Electric up in Fairbanks.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Morgan, a member of the Alternative Energy Team with Golden Valley Electric Association, the electric utility in Fairbanks. Hydrogen has huge potential as in Alaska's energy future and as an exportable commodity. Thus, Golden Valley feels that House Bill 9 is a good idea and notes that it is supported by the Alaska Energy Policy Task Force. Thank you for allowing this testimony.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Morgan? Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Appreciate it. Would hydrogen work up in Fairbanks? You know, batteries don't work so good up there because of the cold climate.
Well, hydrogen has a very low freezing point, so it worked quite nicely up here in terms of temperature. But we have significant wind resources, so we would have the capacity to make our own energy in the interior.
Mr. Morgan, if you'll hold, please, we have a visual aid coming to the...
That's a photovoltaic panel there, and it changes the water into hydrogen and powers the propeller. And this is the storage.
You're blocking your light there.
That's the storage pipeline. And it says, as long as the sun's shining or the wind's blowing or the water's running, you know, it's a perpetual motion.
Wow.
Picture's worth a thousand words.
You have a Bic
especially
lighter.
A running one.
Pardon me? Just say, do you have a Bic lighter handy? See if that's really what we think it is.
Get more, Jake.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've just been
fascinated.
Mesmerized. We're hypnotized.
Bill Ladies online. He can explain this whole thing much better.
Oh, Bill Ladies?
Yes.
Well, let's skip over to you, Mr. Lady. Are you with us?
Hello, this is Bill Leedy.
We're looking at your machine.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Hardenbrook, for bringing that demo. You'll notice that when the sun goes down, that is, he turns the light away from the unit, that it keeps running. This is not perpetual motion, but it is hydrogen stored in that little tiny pipeline. So if that were a larger pipeline, it would store more energy, and that's one of the virtues of hydrogen. It's also important to understand by looking at that little demonstrator unit that hydrogen is not an energy source, as Rep. Crawford said, but you need an energy source in order to make the hydrogen. So Alaska's particular niche in the emerging hydrogen sector of some sort of a sustainable global energy economy, which we all desire, is that we may have opportunities to bring Alaska's resources, both fossil and renewable resources, to distant markets via pipelines or other means of compressing or liquefying the hydrogen. We may also be able to demonstrate in a research way and then use in a long-term practical way storage of hydrogen at large scale, either in geologic formations or in very large tanks filled with the abundant zeolites that we have as mineral resources here in the state. And we also have a number of villages which are functionally islands, and a research project going on in Norway now on the island of Utsira is demonstrating the interface between wind power, hydrogen for storing the energy, and then various ways of converting it back into electricity as it's needed. So the bill that's before you that would facilitate this partnership might offer opportunities for the state of Alaska to serve as a research and eventually as a production location for the new technologies that really are just beginning to emerge and need a fair amount of R&D help. I want to caution you, though, that you probably shouldn't look at HB9 as just a way of garnering some more federal funds to support something within the state. I was at the National Hydrogen Association annual meeting in D.C. several weeks ago, where everyone agreed that there's too much earmarking already going on within the hydrogen R&D program, which is relatively small. It's only $35 to $40 million in the whole U.S. government. So whatever the state does, should this plan go forward, the bill be passed, and the partnership be created in the Department of Commerce, great cooperation with the Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, would be important. The partnership template has also been used at the international level. The International Partnership for the Hydrogen Economy was created in a ministerial meeting in November 03 in Washington, D.C., and I was there to watch the proceedings. The U.S. DOE, Canada, and several states have done hydrogen roadmaps, and this might be one of the first tasks for a hydrogen partnership within the Department of Commerce to do, to see what Alaska's particular strategic advantages are. If you look at Section 2.D.4, infrastructure, that's where Alaska's great R&D and eventually production and export opportunity might be. I also want to caution you that transmission and storage of hydrogen is very difficult and expensive because of the low energy density of hydrogen. It has only one-third the energy density by volume of natural gas. So if you were to pipeline hydrogen from, say, coal gasification on the North Slope or elsewhere, or renewable sources, you need three times the pipeline capacity to move the same volume of energy as you do with natural gas. So I speak in favor of the bill. I think it would be a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Lady. I believe it's the will of this committee to give you and Representative Crawford an A on your science project. It's very impressive. Representative Gatto, did you have a question for Mr. Lady?
I have a couple of questions. As the sponsor mentioned, and I believe I quote him almost exactly, as long as the sun shines or the wind blows or the water stays in motion, we can generate enough power to do electrolysis and produce hydrogen. Tell me right or wrong.
Well, that's true.
Well,
those
on,
are
on,
those
on.
Are renewable
I didn't get
resources.
To the question yet.
But the question is, can we afford to get them to market? They're stranded resources, just like ANS gas. Anything we make within the state of Alaska is going to be stranded as well.
Now, let me ask you the question now. Assuming the premise, which I believe is the correct premise, the amount of energy that we got from the sun, the wind, or the water is probably greater than the energy we're going to get from making hydrogen and being able to convert the hydrogen back to energy. So it sounds to me like as long as we've got the sun, the wind, or the water, we're better off using it rather than to run something rather than using it to generate hydrogen. Is that
yes, fair? That's exactly right. You should use it in the form that's most convenient at the site where you can make the energy if you can use it there. We're referring to the problem of having more abundant resources than we can use in a particular locale or even within the state of Alaska. Meanwhile, the people in the lower 48 need more energy in the form of natural gas or any other form that we can bring it to them. And so it might be possible to export large-scale stranded renewable resources as hydrogen in pipelines or in other ways. But anytime you convert energy from sunlight to electricity to hydrogen, every one of those conversion steps has an energy loss. It's not 100% efficient, so you're correct about that as well.
Follow-up, Representative Gatto?
And this one's a killer. If you were to have a hydrogen car, according to, and I've been reading as much as I could about hydrogen in Discover magazine and some of the more popular things, not necessarily Scientific American, but it said if you parked your car at Anchorage Airport on Monday and you came back the following Monday, you'd be out of fuel.
That's if your fuel were liquid hydrogen, because just like any other cold liquid, it's going to change back into a gas. Most of the car makers have abandoned liquid fuel because just to liquefy hydrogen costs you a third of the energy and the hydrogen to run the refrigerators to liquefy it. Most of the car makers now will be using high pressure gas, and by high pressure I mean 5 to 10,000 psi stored in carbon filament wound gaseous containers on board the vehicle. And they will not lose any energy over years of time. It's only the liquid fuel that you're talking about that's regasifying.
Mr. Lady, another follow-up by Representative Gatto.
Actually, Mr. Leahy, I believe it was not liquid fuel, but rather high-pressure gas. It's just that, as you had mentioned, the molecule of hydrogen is able to permeate or penetrate through almost any container and simply drift away. And the idea being that unless you use it up quickly and replace it quickly, it really doesn't have much of a shelf life.
Sorry, I'll have to disagree with that. You should go to quantum.com. This is the major manufacturer of the high-pressure cylinders, and learn all you'd like to about it there. But you're right. The hydrogen molecule is so small that it's very elusive and will get through most anything. But these high-pressure cylinders have been engineered to not allow that to happen, because you can't have people parking their cars in the garage, a fairly contained space, and have hydrogen be leaking and building up to a dangerous level in there. So I think you'll find that if that was a problem at one time, it's been solved.
Thank you. Representative Seaton?
Yes, I was watching one of the programs on, I forget what program it was, but it was on hydrogen for the future. And one of the nice things that they were showing was there's some new solid-state technology for adsorbing hydrogen into solid, not at high pressure. And of course, there was patents and all that kind of stuff and working on it. Have you been following that, and does that have any potential for us here?
Yes, again, that's mostly applicable to the problem of vehicle storage, getting enough fuel on board the vehicle to give the American driver the couple hundred mile range. The solid form would be more attractive because it operates at a lower pressure, but you have to heat the material to accept the hydrogen and then heat it again to release the hydrogen, both the metal hydrides and the solid materials. The leader in that is energy conversion devices, if you want to go to their website and see what they're doing. But yes, that's a candidate, but it's not yet competitive with the high-pressure gas storage.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Leahy? Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate all your insight and your expertise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we go to Sarah Fisher-Goat? Sarah, I think you're with us, and you can talk a little bit about the fiscal note.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Can you tell us a little bit about the fiscal note, the $95,000 fiscal note?
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher-Goad with the Alaska Energy Authority. I also have with me David Lockhart and Peter Krimp, who are two of our project managers. Peter's with the Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency Program. With regard to the fiscal note, because there does need to be a starting point with this bill, and if this bill passes for the partnership, we would need receipt authority, the statutory designated receipt authority through the Department of Commerce, in order to get the program started. And the plan would be to hire a person to be able to then start staffing the partnership and then applying for federal grants that would be available.
Sarah, do we think that we'll be able to attract federal research dollars to work on this so that it won't become a burden on the general fund?
Through the chair, I don't see how it would be a burden on the general fund. With the initial assumption is that we'd need statutory designated receipts, which would essentially be perhaps some utilities or some private sources potentially that would request the state to seek out these federal grants. And if the federal grants aren't available, as Representative Crawford pointed out, there are conditional effective dates, and there also would be repeal sections if the federal money doesn't pan out.
Perfect. Any questions for Ms. Goad with the AEA? Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate you staying online. Please say hello to Ray for me.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Chris Rose, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Rose. I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, REAP. which is a coalition of diverse stakeholders around the state, including utility companies, environmental groups, consumer groups, and businesses who all want to promote renewable energy. We support this bill for a number of reasons. First of all, we're all using hydrogen right now in other forms. Essentially, the energy we derive from wood or coal or gas or natural gas or any of the other fossil fuels that we're using is the hydrogen that's part of that fuel. What we are moving toward as a society over the last 100 years or so is a purer and purer form of hydrogen. And so we have CH4, which is methane, natural gas, only has one carbon atom on it. If we can get to a point where we can use just hydrogen, not only are we using essentially a pure fuel, but it's also clean. We've got a lot of concerns in the future in order to use this kind of technology in the storage and transportation of it, and that was alluded to by several folks who testified already today. We believe that this is one area or one niche that Alaska could really get into in terms of research and development. That is, in many ways, one of the things that's missing in order for this hydrogen economy to move forward is storing it and transporting it around. Mr. Lady talked about the Utsira project in Norway. That's something that we're looking at as well, and folks are looking at the possibility of applying that kind of research to hydrogen, what a hydrogen village would look like here in Alaska. We've got many, many, over 200 villages that are standalone utilities that could possibly start generating their own hydrogen right there rather than importing expensive diesel, which they cannot control the price of. We also agree that this could be the beginning of a hydrogen roadmap for the state of Alaska. And the reason why this is so exciting for Alaska, and it's been alluded to but maybe not explicitly said, is we have so many abundant renewable energy resources here in this state. The Aleutian Islands probably have 99% of the Class 7 wind in North America. That may not mean a lot to most people, but anything Class 4 and above is commercially viable wind.
Chris, let's try and stay on hydrogen.
Okay. Well, I'm pointing out that that's the resource that we would be using to make the hydrogen. We've got a lot of stranded resources out there, geothermal and wind, that could be used to make the hydrogen through electrolysis. And that's what Mr. Levy was referring to, is places where we may have an abundancy, but we can't use it right there. We also have an excellent fuel cell program up at the university at Fairbanks that this could dovetail well with. So we'd like to see this move on and try to attract some dollars from out of state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Is there anybody else online? Is there anybody here that wants to?
Yeah, I just wanted to fill in a little bit about what he said.
Sure.
One of the things that he was talking about was the Aleutians takes us down close to Japan. One of the things that they've talked about is putting a hydrogen pipeline down the Aleutians to go to Japan with wind generators along the way that would continuously fill that pipeline indefinitely. That's one of the projects that's being talked about.
Wow.
So that's he was staying on the topic.
That's a lot of pipe.
Yes, it's a lot of wind,
a lot of pipe. Anybody else that wants to testify? We're going to close public testimony. Committee? Discussion? Representative Gatto?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was looking through the fiscal notes on this, and we've got about $250,000 that we appear to be spending in three separate locations. That's
the same one.
It's got three different departments, though.
I know, but it's all the same one.
Well, one is 95, one is 74, and then the next one goes and hits 95 again, I believe, and then the fourth one is zero.
Representative Crawford, can you address that for us?
The one added some travel time to the 74, if I understand correctly. And I think it's all the same one, and it's program receipts related. If they don't get the money from the grants to start this project, it doesn't get started. There's no general fund money going to it.
After year one, is that correct?
I thinking well, was by grants to begin with.
Do you know more about it?
Yes.
Or go back.
Sarah, are you with us, Sarah Goad?
No, she's still there.
Sarah, can you help us clarify that, please?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman. The way the bill is structured is that this is a Department of Commerce program. And Commerce has requested that the Alaska Energy Authority be the point agency on this issue because of our experience with energy programs. So the first fiscal note from Commerce is the actual intake of the statutory designated program receipts. And those, again, would be a private entity requesting that the state of Alaska pursue this program. The second fiscal note is to the Alaska Energy Authority, which is an interagency receipts from the Department of Commerce. And the third fiscal note is recognizing that AEA does not have staff. ADA employees staff AEA programs. So if there is a fiscal note that AEA needs to do that requires a person, we have to have an accompanying ADA fiscal note to have that position come in. I apologize for the three fiscal notes. It's just a way for the legislature to see how this money would flow. And again, it is not general fund. It would be assumed to be some type of private source.
That's okay. You walked us through it quite nicely. Do you have any questions, Representative Gatto, for Sarah?
Just the source of the funds. Who's going to cough up the money? I still don't know.
Sarah, can you help us with that, please?
Well, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it's my understanding that there are some potential private sources that would be available. And true, I guess I personally don't know of one in particular. However, we have heard, and through the Department of Commerce, that I believe there's been the Alaska Power Association has mentioned that there would be private entities available to pay for this, for the state to get this partnership up and running.
Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some of the same problem that Representative Gatto has, and that is, what if the money doesn't forthcome at the end of the second, at the beginning of the second year? So then it becomes a burden on the general fund because you'll be back to the general fund for money. That's question number one. And number two, once we've made this investment down the line, if it's successful, will we, the general fund, be receiving anything like we do from oil?
Sarah?
Well, through the chair, I guess with the way the fiscal note is structured and that there's conditional effects, that if the funding isn't secured, whether it's through federal sources or private sources, this partnership would be repealed. And so I think the purpose is not to be a burden on the general fund, and there wouldn't be a drain on the general fund at all. I mean, if we are successful in receiving federal funds, I could see where we could come in for federal receipt authority to receive a federal grant to do the program.
You have a follow-up, Representative Elkins?
Well, I thank you, Mr. I find it hard to believe that if the federal grants don't come through within the first year that you'll fold your tent and go someplace else. We've already got an investment. I just find it hard to believe that you wouldn't come back and say, well, just one more time and we'll get this federal money.
Sarah, do you have a point of view on that? Does AEA have a point of view?
Well, through the chair, I guess looking at the intent of the bill with the conditional effective dates or the conditional effects on the bill and the repealers, I don't see where AEA would request general fund dollars the way this bill is structured.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think the concern is that the legislature might put forward another bill to fund hydrogen energy research, but the legislature would have to put forward a bill to do that because the repealers are built into this. So I don't think that we can, I don't think we can put conditions on future legislatures and prevent them from coming forward to legislation to do hydrogen research. But, you know, as I read this bill, it's pretty tight as far as not obligating any general funds into the future, and then we take another action of the legislature to do that, and I'm willing to let future legislatures take that action or not.
Any more questions for Sarah? Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not our intent to burden the general fund. The repealers are built in. We intend to do this with private donations or funds and with federal funds, and I don't know how to make it any clearer. And the repealers are right there. It, like Representative Seaton says, it would take a separate bill to ever fund this this partnership with anything other than what we've got here. So it's as clear as I can possibly make it.
Thank you, Representative Crawford. I'd like to point out two things to the committee, and then we can continue. One is this bill will go to finance, and the second, when you're framing your questions for the sponsor, please bear in mind it is his birthday today. So is it, Representative Gatto?
Thanks again. I lost my place just a second. Page 2, line 17, members of the partnership shall be appointed by the commissioner blanky blank, and then line 28, the partnership members shall serve without compensation but are entitled to transportation expenses and per diem as authorized for members of boards and commissions. Somehow there's money in here, but it says there's no money for 05, and yet we're spending money for traveling per diem. And I don't know where it's coming from. But then lastly, do we have a part of this that indicates, and now we get into pers terz again. When you serve on a board and a commission, I want to make sure that we're not covering a new employee again. Because we have spent a great deal of time trying to solve the pers terz issue, and one big concern was we can't afford to take on some new employees at very low rates of pay and get them in where they're now qualified for life to be in a certain tier system. And so without those sideboards in there, to overuse the word, it does show that we're spending money somehow, and B, I don't really want to hire any new employees until we put these safeguards in place. And it's hard for me to support a bill that both those things happen.
Representative Crawford?
Mr. Chairman, it shows that we're going to spend $95,000 of not general funds, not public money, but private money. And that's where it's coming from. And I don't believe that it was our intention, and we didn't write it up the way to make the members of this board be part of PERS or TERS or any other retirement system.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I've served on boards and commissions that the legislature has put together, and I didn't receive any PERS benefit from that whatsoever.
Thank you, Representative.
I don't think that's an issue. I mean, maybe if you're on the board of game or board of fish, perhaps, but this is being on a board or commission is not a paid position. You just get reimbursed for travel expenses and hotel.
And
eating, yeah, that's.
Thank you, Representative Capser. Representative Stevens.
And Mr. Chairman, we did recently put in a disclaimer, so that wouldn't be the case, and we have followed up with boards and commissions, and we have found that the typical boards and commissions such as this do not qualify for retirement benefits. So, otherwise, I would have again offered that same amendment, and thank you for raising the concern. But at least boards and commissions. Verifies that it's not a problem.
Representative Capser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In relation to the $95,000, and especially if it's not coming out of the general fund, I think that is a good case of spend now, save later. We spend an exorbitant amount on subsidizing rural Alaskans for diesel fuel in recognition that there is not affordable energy sources other than diesel. It looks like we're going to be stuck with diesel for a while, unfortunately. We're not seeing wind generation. I mean, I know that you have a bill in, Mr. Chairman, that explores wind generation and alternative energy. But, when we are willing to appropriate a lot of money to Arctic Power to go and lobby for opening ANWR, I mean, this pales in comparison to the appropriations we've made for just Arctic Power alone, just for lobbying efforts. I mean, this would be a step in the right direction on alternative energy. And, you know, we do a lot of lip service on trying to find other energy sources besides diesel fuel, and I think this is definitely a step in the right direction.
Thank you, Representative Capser. Representative Elkins?
Just real quick, I'm going to support this bill because my friend on the right introduced it, but I do want to just say one more time, I think once we're hooked, we're hooked. And that's, I just want that on the record.
Representative Cotto?
Thanks. How do we pay per diem and travel if we haven't collected money yet? Isn't the board's position to go ahead and find the money?
Mr. Sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the Rail Belt utilities don't step in with money to start this, the whole thing's not going to start. It won't get off the ground. If we can't find the money to begin this process, then it won't happen. And once again, we're only hooked if we pass another bill that doesn't have this repeater.
Representative Gatto?
Well, we passed this unanimously twice last year. And
twice? Last year?
Yes. We did it during the regular session, and then we did it again on the last night and put it into another energy bill and sent it over to the other body, and they took it out.
And you voted yes.
That was it.
Twice.
That was in an even numbered year.
Well, Representative Crawford, I'm a big fan. I share your interest and belief in alternate energy, and I too am a son of Kyoto, as I've been so named. Our rules chairman, if he's listening, who's a dear friend. So are there any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Seed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move House Bill 9 /G with attached additional notes and individual recommendations.
Any objections to HB 9? Seeing none,
happy
HB
birthday.
9 passes. Well done, Mr. Birthday Boy.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Before we adjourn today, I just would like to give the committee a heads up as to what is coming our way. We're going to have a resolution courtesy of the president of the other body regarding the Kensington gold mine, and then we also are going to have a resource bill that relates to a self-assessment tax by the mining industry that we're going to take up here shortly. So with that, it's 2:40 in the afternoon. We'll be adjourned.